Today's date is August 26, 1997. The speakers are Warren Hinderly and Peter Cohan. The topic is storytelling, home sweet home, and other places.
Okay, my name is Warren Hinderly, and I am the village storyteller for this week. By that, it simply means that I'm sort of the village story impresario, because clearly everybody here is walking with 1,001 stories, enough to get you out of any corner. Today, I am going to present the part of our two-part program, which is entitled Home Sweet Home and Other Places. The structure of stories and the stories of structure. Now, the structure of stories is fairly simple. I've been dying to tell you all along that to tell a story is not the same as to write it. And if you remember these two principles, you will find yourself able to hold the attention of almost anybody for the length of the story that you have to tell. And the two principles are simply, you raise a question in the minds of your listener, a question that will keep their attention on your story. This question is usually directly describing the plot or the through line of your thoughts, your story. And the second principle of the structure of stories is simply repetition. This is where stories become art. And I believe buildings do too. Right?
Right.
And with this, we will discover a variety of repetition in the stories that I tell and you tell and Peter Cohan tells. Now, I'd like to give you all permission to give Peter Cohan a hand. He's our resident architect for Holden Village for this week and my partner on this session.
Thank you. My portion of the program will be to show you some pictures. I wish we could visit some buildings, because that's the best way to find out about the stories that they tell, but to show you some slides of several buildings. And based upon the principles that Maren outlined, first of all, raising a question, and second of all, repetition, I wonder if we might be able to apply that to the stories that these buildings tell. That may be the way that we can tie this together.
That's right.
So, oh, by the way, let me say a little bit about myself. Peter Cohan is my name. I teach architecture at the University of Washington in Seattle, and I'm an architect on the side, and I've been coming up here for many years. The first role that I filled here was that of the village potter. I was the potter here for many summers during the 70s and early 80s. So now we're going to proceed with some stories.
Well, yes, I'll introduce these principles of the structure of stories by telling you a story. And this is a story you may not have heard, but it is an old folk tale that has I found in a card shop. Well, I changed the title. I didn't like the title, so I changed it. We'll call this The Wise Woman. The Wise Woman of the City. And you can decide what city this is. There was once a king, a powerful and wealthy king, who decided he didn't like his humble abode. He wanted a palace that would speak for his family and for his country and provide a space for generations to come. So he hired his architects and his carpenters, and they went to work. They sawed down the huge cedar trees, and they created a palace of great width and height and majesty. And then a fire raged the land and burned it to the ground. "This was clearly a mistake," said the king, "but I am determined to have a palace, and a palace I will have, a palace that will endure." So he called the masons and he said, "The carpenters did a lousy job, get to work." And they did. They created a hall of marble and alabaster, a huge, enormous palace with many balconies and fountains and glorious and grand spaces with which to impress himself, his court, any visitors, and everyone in the land. And then an earthquake rushed through the land and tore the building down. Fortunately, the family survived. Maybe they hadn't moved in yet. At any rate, he was standing outside the rubble and saying, "So what am I to do? Where is the architect who can build a house to last 1,000 years? And then up spoke a woman many knew as the storyteller, Marin. And Marin said, "I, sir, can build you a palace that will last beyond time, as long as there is breath and words to speak it." "Is that so? Well, who is this woman anyway?" And he went to his counselors, and his counselors said, "Oh, she's the daughter of Mary." Now, Mary was powerful with words. She could raise forests, mountains, and deserts simply by opening her mouth and speaking. And before she died, she passed this power on to her daughter. Someone who can create landscapes ought to be able to create a palace. All right, let's see what you can do, and if you can do it, I will reward you." So Marin went to work, and as she spoke, fountains flowed, gardens bloomed, and the walls of the palace were raised in azure and crimson, and the ceilings were laid in gold and turquoise and violet, and all was as it should be. And so the king had his palace. And when the king died, he made sure that his sons and daughters had it too. And on it went until I give it to you. And that is the Palace of Words. So, in this story, we raise a question. What's the question?
How do we build?
What?
Sonia? I don't know. How do we build a castle that will last forever?
Good. That's a good way to put it. Anybody else have another way to put it? My guess is any one of you listening to the story is going to have your own way of stating this. And it's the way you got interested. And the only reason I ask is that if you know something more about yourself than you knew before the story started. Because when you know the kinds of questions you ask that are of interest to you, then you know what you want to find out. And I would like to suggest that perhaps that is also the case with a building.
That's a beautiful intro. Architects tell stories too, and I think they tell stories about, good architects tell stories about the cultures that they're in, the people that they build for, and the materials of which they build. So I'm going to show you a building, and rather than describing it to you, I think I got an idea, which is to actually have you begin to ask, what are the questions that this building asks, and what kind of repetition occurs within the building, and also, what is this story about? So let me prepare a room. I will describe this building only factually and minimally, and ask you to pipe in and begin to tell me what this building might be and what it might be about. It's in Stockholm. It was built by an architect named Gunnar Asplund in 1925. It sits in the heart of the city. This is what architects commonly refer to as a site plan, so it'll help you to locate it since you're not walking there. On the bottom is a very busy road called Sveavägen, one of the main thoroughfares through Stockholm. It leads right to the heart of the city, which is that way. This is a very heavily trafficked business district, but there's a park right here, and a church way up on the hill. It's a very hilly, steep slope. And the building which Gunnar Asplund designed is on the corner, on the busy commercial corner, but it also has a very strong relationship to the park. Asplund also designed parts of the park, and you'll see in a moment, I'll show you a picture of this beautiful reflecting pond skating rink that sets in front of, or to the south. Yeah, that's the Venetian blind. I wonder if somebody might... But do I have any, are there any questions yet about this building? What, when you look at it, what do you think?
You just answered the question. I was wondering if that was a long entrance into the building.
It's a circle and a square, yeah. Any thoughts about what it might, what function it might serve?
Inside the circle, people meet, people talk, people decide, and everything else is to support that.
Oh, that's good. Mm-hmm. You should be.
That's really good.
Anybody else have it?
Anybody else?
It looks like a pop-up application.
It looks like a what?
Pop-up.
A pop-up? You mean like it popped up out of the center of the building? That's cool. I've never thought about that.
It does look like a pop-up. It also looks like a hat.
Yeah.
And the entrance and that tall, narrow glass door with the reflection of, is that the sun or the moon? It's a place where some reflection is going to happen.
A reflection. I've never seen that before, Mar, and it does look like it's the sky and the sun.
There's a world inside that door.
Okay, so let me back up a tick. Okay, so let me describe it a little bit. So we're on the park side, and you come around, you follow the street, and then there's a low series of buildings, which Asplund also designed. He didn't design the McDonald's in that end building. You can see the golden arches against the red background. They're even in Stockholm now, even in famous buildings. But as you follow up the street, eventually there's a cleft in the face of storefronts, and then there's this long, shallow series of steps that lead up to the main entry. Otherwise, all four sides are identical. The plinth of the platform in the front helps to compensate for the slope of the site so that it allows, so only on that side is that main huge door elevated up above the street. So you finally arrive at that door.
This is the door.
This is the door handle.
Those are the door handles.
What is it? Adam and Eve.
In all their glory.
And what are they
before
doing?
Their fall.
So So you come up to this big, huge glass door, and actually the real door is much, much smaller. It is only about this high. And it's all glass. You reach out, and there is this bronze Eve holding the apple. What does that make you think?
Garden of Eden.
Garden of Eden. Annie, does it begin to tell you perhaps what this building might be?
Botanical garden.
Could be either a museum or a library. A place of knowledge.
A museum or a library. Knowledge. Yeah, that sounds good. Okay, so let's go a little bit farther in. Now we're in the entry lobby.
Ooh, that looks like books.
The antechamber. We can already begin to see what it might be, because looking way up into the center of the cylinder, we see
books.
Shelves of books.
But somehow, you know, suddenly occurs to me that this recalls a pyramid.
Mm-hmm. I think it does. I think it has very strong, I mean, the Egyptian flavor is obviously there. If you hadn't caught it already from the door, you can see the door is repeated again on the inside. I love this, and then these strange little stairs that are peeping out the sides and the interstitial space between the cube and the cylinder.
The repetition of the steps is really wonderful in terms of the symbolism.
And speaking of repetition, what's really interesting is that this doorway, that this portal that we now go through, looks identical to the one on the outside, but actually it's much, much smaller.
Oh, yeah.
But we've changed scale. When you move into a building, everything changes. And so although it looks, if you don't think about it, you would say they're the same size, but this is actually maybe a third the size of the one outside.
And it has a cryptic sense, a sense of mystery about it, it seems to me.
Yeah, what about some of your feelings about entering this building? What would you feel as you were going up into this building? Mary, is that what you're doing?
It's kind of quiet.
Quiet?
Make a lot of noise.
Yeah. Is it playful?
No.
Is it humorous?
It takes a long time and a lot of work to get where you need to go.
you have a lot of time to think about it, too, don't you? I mean, it really is a monumental event entering into this building. Here's moving forward a little bit and looking up that stair. And so one of the things that I love that the architect is doing, beyond a lot of the less sort of obvious things, is I love the way he tries to describe the base of that cylinder inside this building. Remember, we saw the cylinder on the outside coming down into the building. And here, by using the stair, he tries to almost imply that this cylinder was just jammed right down into there, and it still exists. Those outside walls of that cylinder still exist within the building.
And also, I love the change in elevation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rise implied that you go to heights.
Yeah. It also seems that some of the steps are more gradual going up than others, like maybe lower steps.
That's true.
So the Tree of Knowledge. So where are we going then? If Adam and Eve were there, you know, is this the Garden of Eden, or what else might it be? Here's heading up the stairs. And what we might have seen earlier now becomes more clear is hanging from the center of this space by the thinnest of cables is a gigantic semicircular light fixture that hangs in the heavens.
When you look up in that picture, is that the top of the cylinder?
But you know, I guess I don't really have any pictures of the top of the cylinder.
No, what I mean is that where it is, like up there.
And finally we arrive at the Great Room. Has anybody seen this is obviously a library, so has anybody ever seen a Great Room in a library? Great rooms and libraries are fun to design, but I think this is one of the all-time greatest. Surrounding the walls in 360 degrees are three tiers of books. And along the edge, you can't read it because the slides aren't that sharp, but Dansk, Norsk, English, it's a world of books. And it's all of the different countries represented by these books. This isn't the entire collection. This is an old-fashioned library. As a matter of fact, Gunnar Asplund, this was the first public library in Sweden. And the United States was way ahead of the game. We had Carnegie libraries, so Gunnar Asplund actually came to the U.S. to look at Carnegie libraries. And he got a lot of the ideas from the way a Carnegie library is organized with the great room in the center. But this is still the old kind of library where most of the books you had to ask for. And so, interestingly enough, the circulation desk, which sits right in the center of the composition, had a little dumbwaiter. And down below the great cylinder was just a labyrinth of books, all radiating out from the center. So you can imagine there's a librarian down there who's operating from the center and gets an order for a book and runs off. I often wondered, since there's no light down there, if maybe they had cardinal points, you know, north, south, east, west, and operated like a big top. And then would send the book up. What is this to you? What, if you were in this building, what would you think of this room as representing?
Just incredible control of knowledge going on. You don't have access to the stacks.
That's right.
That would be very difficult for me.
Well, but that's a historical convention, actually.
Yes, true.
Yeah. But yeah. I think the thought that you would just be able to, anybody would be able to go to any book they wanted to, would have been outrageous in 1925, probably.
Although they can go to some, because that first tier is definitely open stacks.
They can get to the third tier, too. There's actually... But the bulk of the collection, of course, is down below.
Uh-huh.
This is not actually a reading room. This is only a room of books. It's got the circulation desk, it's book retrieval, and then it's got the books around the edges. The reading rooms are actually off in, back into the square portion of the building. I think I have a picture of one of the doors into the reading room. So this is really, in a way, a sacred space. And it's all about knowledge.
But, you know, the reflection of the lights indicates to me that this deals with more than one dimension. You know, this is not just about the material world. Mm-hmm. We're entering a different dimension.
Yeah, the I'll tell you a little bit about it. The plaster actually is textured. Can you see how the plaster is textured up above so it looks like clouds? My feeling is, I like to say that if Gunnar Asplund could have, he would have left the roof off of this building. He would have just had this great circle of books and then the sky up above. I'll tell you what Asplund thought of this and what his metaphor or his story was for this. I think it's more like the world of knowledge, or it's almost like the universe in a way. And it's got the big sun hanging in the center of the sky. The early designs of this library show a dome rather than a cylinder. And Asplund is thought to have believed that this was a cranium.
Uh-huh.
You are actually going into someone's head. Either your own or maybe the, since it contains all of knowledge, maybe it's the head of God, as Martin mentioned earlier.
But also the mind of all these authors.
Yeah, the mind of the authors too. The library is full of beautiful details. One of the four, so it has four sides that surround the central cylinder. One of the sides is the children's library. And it runs, since it's a very thin piece that's outside the cylinder, it's in a very linear format, the circulation, the books, and when you finally get to the very end of that wing, there's this little semicircular alcove that's the storytelling room. And this is a beautiful painting that was painted on that alcove. I don't remember the name of the figure, but this is the little Swedish folk figure that supposedly brings dreams to children in his umbrella. And so you can see he's floating down. Yeah.
How tall is that ceiling, and how far is it between the last, sort of the highest rung of the books?
Isn't it amazing?
That's the incredible.
I know.
Empty.
It is.
Let alone the heat.
I know. And you know where all the heat went.
Yes.
I know, that's what's so incredible about it, is the extravagance of the room. Whoa!
We're having excitement.
We're having something that's... Part of the reason for that, of course, is the presence on the exterior. It really needed to be up there to be able to project that high. And so,
are those the actual windows we're seeing?
Those are the actual windows.
So the books are down at the rectangular building level.
The books are carved out of the square volume. It's almost as though this is a carved volume. And that's why I like to say that if he could have, he would have left the hat off entirely, as someone described it. In any case, I think that this building tells a powerful story, and one of the things that I like to think about, two things. One is, I experienced this building when I was 30-some years old, and I was taken aback by it. Every time I walked into it, I lived in Stockholm for a year, every time I walked up those steps and through the door and into the great room, there was this real sense of responsibility and the wonder of knowledge, and it really instilled a certain sense of privilege to be in amongst all those incredible minds. And I love to think of a six-year-old or a young child being brought by their parents for the first time up those shallow steps, in the great door, through the black alcove with the Egyptian bas-relief on it, finally up the stairs towards the big light fixture that looks like the sun, and then arriving at the only place that geometrically you can arrive in a cylinder, which is right in this, right at the bottom of the axis that goes right down through the center of it, which architects laud Ostwin forever on how he was able to achieve that, because they've always been frustrated with the way that you enter a circle, because all sides are equal. So you never really enter at a place of privilege. Ostwin figured it out with a cylinder. If you want to enter at the place of privilege, at the place of the strongest orientation, you arrive at exactly the middle, in the right on axis, on the vertical axis. So that's one building story. Do I have time for another building story?
Oh, for sure. Yes.
Okay. The door that you see in the picture, the exterior of the building, is that the door you're entering?
This says hiss, that's elevator.
This one.
That's the side door. That actually leads to, one side leads to a periodicals room, one side, that's the children's library.
Okay.
But, and so you can either enter from the main doors or you can enter that from there.
Then is the door that's coming out to here fully on the other side of the building then?
It's right here.
I can't tell.
Yeah, it's right here.
Well, it's over there on the side.
It's on the platform. So here's those street front buildings, and you cut right up through them, and you end up on a platform right here, and then you enter here. Now, the interesting thing about this, let me see, back up real quickly. I guess, let's see where I am here. Oh yeah, there we go. Here's another side view, and here's all the countries again, and it's always done in the language of that country, or the script, the alphabet of that country. This is...
Oh, look at that, yes, Magyar, that's Hungarian, in Hungarian.
And here is one of the doorways into the upper level reading rooms. There's one on each side. The children's library and the periodicals rooms are below. And so you go out, and what you're looking at is actually the upper portion of one of these. And so there's a real wonderful sense of coming to the middle. You're in the great room, and then there are these big portals on either side, and you're drawn to the light into the big kind of rectangular reading rooms where you're actually meant to be more comfortable. I think that there's a quality of this space that you're never really meant to feel comfortable. You know, you're just kind of a little bit overwhelmed for that. In any case, here's an interesting story. Gunnar Ostwin had a friend, was born in 1885. He had a friend named Sigurd Leverance, who was also born about the same time. Very early in their careers, they won a big competition to design a cemetery and several chapels within the cemetery in the southern suburbs of Stockholm. And it's called Woodland Park Cemetery, and I'm only going to show it to you briefly to show you what they did together. You'll see it's a very simple neoclassical style. It's very similar to the Stockholm Public Library. You enter the stone walls of this cemetery grounds, and there's a little temple that's carved into the side. This was actually designed by Leverance. And there's water running behind the columns, and it's almost as though you're crossing the River Styx, and you're in the land of the dead. And then finally, you look up, and the largest chapel, which was designed in 1945 by Gunnar Asplund, is at the end of a path, but all you can really see is a huge cross that's up against the sky and the slow path that travels up into it. If you continue to follow that path, you go deep, deep into a series of woods that were planted, so they're all parallel rows. And within those woods are various graves. And finally, at the very end of the axis, not there yet. So there's this beautiful plain, and you slowly travel up this wall. At the end of the axis, you come to this Temple of the Resurrection, which is by Sigurd Leverance. And I'm not going to talk about this building, just to show you how similar he was in style and ideas to Gunnar Asplund. Here's the side of it. It had an interesting, it actually had an interesting story to it too. Leverance felt very strongly that you shouldn't enter, this is a funerary chapel where they did cremation. And he felt very strongly that you shouldn't enter the same way, exit the same way that you enter. So you enter on axis and turn left, and then the little chapel and the bier where the coffin, I guess, goes before it's incinerated is at this end. And then when the service is over, rather than come out this way, you turn around and you come straight out this door, and it drops you down into another yard of gravestones that's kind of sunken, and it has a wonderful room-like quality and surrounded by trees. So the analogy has often been to death and resurrection. You go into the tomb, and then you can see how tomb-like this looks. And then finally, after death, you come out into paradise.
Also, the tallness of these trees, the age of these trees, equal to the height of the building, and it's interesting. Or they even tower above it, which is very interesting, I think.
Yeah. And the building itself is so tall.
Because the building is so tall already, yes.
This was designed in 1925, about the same time as the library. Sigurd Leverance lived a long life, but he was a crusty old man, and he got frustrated with architecture, so he bought a window manufacturing plant. And for about 25 years, what he mostly did was designed and manufactured steel windows for other architects. He was finally persuaded to come out of retirement, and in his 80s, he designed two churches. So I'll tell you ahead of time that this is a church. And this one was designed in 1966.
Before you go on, what's the bas relief in the frieze?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Because that is just a huge entrance for that size of building.
It sure is.
Yeah, it is, and it's again. This is a chapel designed by Sigurd Leverance in 1925. This is a church designed by Sigurd Leverance in 1966.
Oh my goodness.
He didn't do anything for 25 years, except design window frames. What's going on here? Does anybody want to hazard a guess what it is or what it's about? It's
like a prison.
Looks like a prison?
Yes. To me it does.
Yes. Anything else?
Fortress.
A fortress?
Yeah.
What did you say? Sony?
I think that he must have gotten depressed or something.
Let me describe it to you briefly again. It actually sits very much like Asplund's building. It has two. It's in a town, so it's not a huge urban setting. But it's got town buildings on the back two sides, and then it's surrounded by a park on two other sides. So one of the main approaches is through the park. It's actually a big square building, surrounded by an L-shaped building. So there's this little internal outdoor street that separates the community rooms, the offices, the Sunday school rooms from the sanctuary itself. What strikes you about this building?
To return, to our thing about questions.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, the striking thing for me is, why is this so horizontal?
So minimal to me.
So minimal. Any other, let's ask other questions. What are these things?
Yes.
To me that looks like a place where you...
Why are the light fixtures bent? That's actually a question I've wondered for a long, long time. And look at these odd windows. You may not be able to see these windows, but they're actually just big plates of glass slammed up against these holes in these brick walls and held on by the simplest of clips in about two places per side, and then kind of gasketed all the way around.
Part of the window frame.
This is from a guy who designed steel window frames for 25 years.
He probably was wondering the whole time if he could do it without a frame.
I think you'll find out why that happens in a moment. Yeah.
I think that the light fixtures are bent because they don't need as much light on the other side. They're right on the edge of the thing. I mean, go yeah.
I actually think they're bent because they're bowing.
Oh.
But that's only my own theory about this.
How wonderful.
How many are there?
The other thing is the brick. Look at the brick. Look at this wall over here.
Before you switch, she has a question.
The light, you mentioned light switch. How many are there? Is there three there? I can see
there two. Are three there, but there are more scattered around.
Well, here's where I'm going with this. It kind of looks to me like the entrance to a barn, and we have three wise men here bowing, and if we go on in here, maybe like manger type thing.
Oh, That's good.
I've never heard that one before. So, actually, if you want to get orientation to this again, here's these funny little finger brick chimneys that are right here. They're actually right here. And so we're entering, here's the big box, and then this is part of the L-shaped box, and that other view is looking, this is just a freestanding wall. And so we're looking this way down the length, and as I said, these are all kind of the social rooms. Okay, let's go into the building a little bit further. Oh, wrong one again. Boy, I'm all messed up. Finally, you find your way, let me just back this off again. You find your way to the narthex.
Is that the entry to the narthex?
I always get that mixed up. An architecture person, no less. And it's very dark. The narthex also functions as a little bridal chapel, and so there's a little teeny altar. But as it was on the outside, it is on the inside. It's all brick with a few steel beams. And as soon as you go in there, you saw how few windows there were on the outside. Your eyes start adjusting to the light. And gradually, you see that one of the walls in the narthex slides off into the next room. It's almost as though it's defined on three sides. And gradually, one of the wall continues into the main sanctuary. You have to stand here for about 5 minutes before you can see anything. It's so dark. There are four windows, square windows. The walls are deep, deep brick. And already I think you can begin to understand why the glass is applied the way it is. There's no sense of the glass at all. No frame, because the glass is actually bigger than the opening. There's absolutely no sense of the glass. They could just be wide open openings. But you stand there for a while. The first thing that you notice as you feel your way along the brick wall is that the bricks are actually undulating underfoot. So we've got bricks in the ceiling, bricks in the wall, bricks on the floor, and it's not level.
It isn't. It's weedy.
And if you go in there by yourself, as you can see I was, you hear this dripping. Drip, 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 and it echoes, you can imagine, all brick building. And what the dripping is that there's a gash in the floor right here. Let me see if I've got another slide right. Yeah. There's a gash in the floor. And the brick floor seems to have undulated, risen up right in front of it. It's almost as though this was ripped open somehow. And water comes up a little brass spigot and drips into this gigantic shell.
Which is the baptismal
font. That's the baptismal font. But that's not what you hear, not the dripping from here to here, but from the lowest scallop of the shell. The water drips down into this chasm. And there's a pool of water in that chasm, and that's the dripping that you hear when you walk in.
Oh.
And the reason that you're so aware of it is because you can't, you're not sort of, you're being deprived of your other senses for a while because you can't see anything. You're unsure of your footing, so you can't move forward. And there's this drip, drip, drip. And finally, you come to see this, and you see the gash in the floor, and you realize that you have to go around it. And gradually your eyes get used to the dark, and this is what you see as your eyes get acclimated. That's a, some of these shots are from books and some are my own. The entire sanctuary is brick. It's held up by a huge key column made out of steel, upon which run two gigantic steel beams. From those steel beams, little posts rise up. And on those posts are smaller beams that run back and forth, and they actually tip. They tip in different directions, and then there are these brick vaults that run between those steel beams.
So can any you see them tipping?
Any more associations people want to make?
It's like a crypt.
A crypt? Yeah. I think
it's more like a place of death than it is of life.
It is. I think that's a really good analogy.
I wonder what the experience of attending a service would be like in this place, especially if you didn't know what you were getting into. Boy, oh boy, did that throw you off balance.
It's an overwhelming experience. I think it's a lot like a crypt, too. One of the things that I think of is this seems, it starts to make you feel that you're not above ground at all. That you're actually buried. And this reminds me so much of scaffolding. You know, like you're in a mine or like you're in a crypt, it's somehow it's holding up tons and tons of rock above you, and that may be what the brick is like. It's almost like the rock. And you're deep within the earth. I think it really is about death. I think this is a Good Friday church.
That's a cross.
And yeah, exactly. And this is not only a T-beam, that's a T-column, that's holding up the roof. It's a cross, and look where it is. Wham! Right down in the middle of the congregation. So,
that's great.
They can hardly avoid it. I'll tell you a little side story. You can see these beams wobbling back and forth, and they go up and down a little bit, and you can see what that does to the shape of the arch, because they want to use the same circumference, the same circle for the brick laying, the formwork. When it's at this distance, it makes a pure part of a circle. But when the beams come closer together, it almost makes more of a little truncated vault. It's almost like a Gothic, starts to be almost a Gothic arch. But the reason that Leverance developed this odd system is because he used to have he had one of the first speedboats, and he loved the hull on the underside of his speedboat. And that's one of the sources of inspiration for this. It's actually kind of the hull. He's looking more at this part, and the hull of a boat, rather than kind of these vaulted forms. But that's kind of a...
You know, something else that I'd just like to comment on is the unevenness of the floor recalls to me the sea. And walking on water.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it would humble anyone who thought they could walk in the footsteps of Jesus to consider just walking across that floor with any kind of confidence.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. This is all, one of the things that we talked about with the Osborne Building, and one of the things that building stories do is they don't tell the same story to everybody, and they tell all different kinds of stories.
Yep.
And one of the stories that Leverance loved to tell was a story of materials. He loved materials, and he loved to use them as straightforwardly as possible. So this building, as much as it is, everything that could be is a brick. And it's not a fancy brick, it's not a custom-made brick, it's a standard-sized brick. And no single brick is cut. You can see, you could probably see that earlier, but if you look at the pattern in the floor here, where this kind of row runs into this row, and you can see if he ever couldn't fit a brick in there, he just filled it in with extra mortar. It's almost as though this was a sacred unit, and he wasn't going to break it for any reason. And the other thing is, it's almost as though the brick stuff was built first, and then everything else is just attached. Like, look at the way the door frame over there is just slammed onto the outside of the brick. It's not as though he made the brick bend or give or do anything for the door frame, because the brick was the primary material. I think a lot of the times when Leverance was working on this building, he thought about this building in hundreds of years when it was a ruin.
Hmm.
You know?
What would be left?
Yeah, and he knew that it would be the brick and the steel.
Structure.
And so the wood and the glass takes a very secondary role.
They've got a lot of ruins around.
So here you can see, yeah, as a matter of fact, here you can see how one of, this is a space between two windows, how rather than cut a brick, he'll just leave gaps or fill it in. This is actually, I think, the comparison. This is an old ruin of a castle in southern Sweden. And, you know, it's that big, thick, monolithic walls, and I think that was really the quality that he was trying to achieve in the windows in this church.
I think that maybe he could have thought of the bricks as all of the people, and maybe like the cross or something was God.
That's good, Sony.
Do you ever build anything so that you get a sense that he knows how to use light?
Oh, the light in here is fabulous once your eyes get used to it. And I think this is a good example of it. The way it kind of washes certain parts, it washes the altar. Now, the door, the place where the pastor is, the sacristy, is that where he hangs out before the service?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe? Is that's this door right here. Remember those funny little brick chimneys? Those brick chimneys are actually skylights.
Oh.
But they're the funniest kind of skylights, because when you look up through them, you can see they're placed right across the steel beam. So here's the steel beam coming right across. They're placed in such a way that when you look up in them, it reinforces the notion that you're buried, because you see 6 feet of brick up this shaft and this little bit of light at the very top of it. So the impression that you're really kind of down below the ground is made. But look at the way that those skylights kind of mark the path of the pastor as he moves out from the sacristy to the altar.
Is this actually below land?
No, it's not.
Underground?
No, it's right on the ground.
Huh.
And finally, okay, so here's a nice, the black and white shots sometimes show better because it's a professional photographer, that may be why, but you can really get a sense of the undulating ground, the cross column right in the center of the congregation, the way the ground splits open at the baptistry and reveals that kind of gash in the ground, and also the light coming in from these point sources that seem so bright and brilliant. And then,
you know, in this building, the repetition is connected to the light, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And just like, so we came in here, we kind of slid along this wall, we came in, we had to stop, we had to get used to the dark and the quiet, and then we finally moved down into these seats. What's really interesting is the bricks actually lay out the pattern for where the seats are supposed to go. So even though these are movable seats, the bricks are arranged such that they're kind of positioned already. But when the service is over, you don't go back the way you came.
Let me see if I get this right.
You turn around, these bigger doors swing open, you know, much more light floods into the sanctuary, and you move out again into the park, and there's this beautiful pond, very shallow pond made of brick. But just gradually, it's almost like a shallow, just a hollow in the ground. And there's a little fountain to make the sound of water going. And so after you're kind of in that Good Friday experience, you know, the doors of the tomb are kind of swung open and you, wham, you come right out into the garden again. So that's the story of that building.
Wow. That's amazing.
Let me see if this, I think that's about. And here, there he is, Sigurd Lewrence in his 80s, cigar in hand, look at the size of that stogie, playing around with bricks on the side, and then here's this baptistry again, and then look at the brick patterns, look at the uncut bricks on the edges, it just kind of increases that sense of ripping apart the floor. And then the little cross that's inlaid right there. It's the little details in any building that make it so great. And this seems like such a brutal building. Yet, as you discover it, and as you move through it, and as you move around it, it's these little details that are the embellishment of the tale.
No.
So those are my two building stories, Maren.
Well, they're definitely our stories. They carry you along on a journey. Going to church in this tomb is like, you have a progression. You wouldn't even have to hear a sermon to get the proclamation.
Can you imagine the stories of this architect here with the church committee?
I was wondering too, how did he convince them to build this?
You know, and the thing is, the reaction that I get is often the same. People wonder, wow, can you really have a worship service in there? It seems so dark and so heavy. But let me tell you, it is an absolutely moving space. It's so beautiful. Just the light coming in and that big steel column in the center. It's an amazing, space.
When was it built?
66.
Were any of these bricks painted or anything, or they all just natural?
Painted?
Hey, I've seen it before.
Come on, they paint wood. Give me a break.
Yeah, you can paint brick as long as you don't paint in brick color. Adolf Loos is a famous architect who said you can paint a material as long as you don't paint it to look like that material. Another one.
Ah, that's a good
so
principle.
So none of them were painted?
No, they're not painted. So.
And I imagine his name, he was known as an architect, but he'd been out of the picture for so long. That didn't impress the committees.
Actually, these people knew what they were getting because he had done a church that was not quite as powerful but similar outside of Stockholm, near the old cemetery that he had worked on about 3 years earlier. So it was they were the ones that didn't know what they were doing. And as a matter of fact, the first church that he did, he had to. You notice that the brickwork, the mortar is all very rough. It's almost as though the surface is just smoothed off and there's no tuck pointing or anything. The masons on the first job in Stockholm, he told that he was going to plaster the walls. Because that was the only way he could get them to just kind of scrape the mortar and not finish the joints.
Man.
What denomination?
The plot thickens.
It's all Lutheran.
It's all Lutheran.
It's all Lutheran.
It's all Lutheran.
Well, I am going to close this portion of our program this afternoon with a poem written about a palace of sort, to return to our first story. But this is called The Heavenly Party, and it is a poem, a palace that is constructed with words to celebrate a particular occasion. And I ask you to decide what the occasion is. Our palace of memory has thousands of candles lit from the highest window to the china cabinet. Even the dungeon of lost dreams has one or two. Our unseen guardians shine memories till the palace glows. We recall friends, dear departed souls, and our families forever growing with daughters and sons, flames for everyone. The great aunt with the sight, the grandfather who prayed all night, the dreamer who brought us home, one for our cabin, one for the linden tree, a flame for every memory. Flames surround the throne. Here sits our guest of honor, helpless, homeless, vulnerable, bringing us the gift of love to make us free from all our weary tyrannies. Forgiving, we join this time with people, places, happenings that occupy our hearts and minds. After rejoicing with the fragrance of food made by tradition through generations of celebration, we carry packages of thankfulness to share the joy of being free, of being you, of being me. So, where what celebration takes place in this palace of memory?
I think it would be an anniversary.
Well, that's good.
Of a birthday.
A birthday. That's also good. It's definitely one that includes a community, doesn't it? And that's one kind of shelter. A shelter for our celebrations. Now I have a little cornerstone here. We were chatting before we started, Peter and I, and we were saying, you know, there's a place in Holden that could be commemorated with stories. And we were saying, yes, here it is. What do you think? The main street?
The seasons.
The seasons? The place where the Holden adventure for most people begins and ends, because that's the departure and the arrival point, right?
These buildings that tell different kinds of stories, and we haven't talked about the stories of buildings as they age and as they're lived in and as they're loved in and as people grow in them and out of them and move through them. And I think that's another kind of a story.
Yes.
I have so many stories that I associate with days buildings. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I'm talking to someone about when they were at Holden, years aren't as important to me as, oh, you were here when they had the first garage, or before the addition on the Quinonia. But before the addition on the Quinonia, there were windows on this side that were just like windows on that side, and you could sit over where you guys are and look into the woods. So oftentimes that means more to me in terms of when someone was here and what histories are associated with that than actual years.
The last time I was here, there was a fireplace in the middle of this room. And if it was raining, we'd build a fire today.
Yeah, we would have had.
Yeah. Well, we have this stone, and we're going to pass it around, and you can hold it and share the memory of a place, here or there or somewhere. it's okay to just pass it, but it's also okay to tell a story when you're holding it.
Sorry, do you have a memory of any place that you can think of?
What do you mean?
A place where something happened to you that you remember well.
Well, since we have this right there, I'm going to tell a story about a few summers ago. And my dad, right there, was juggling me around, just, you know, throwing me over my shoulders, and he was joking to it. And my mom said, "Be careful," and he said, "Oh, I'll never drop me her." And then after a little while, he dropped me right on my head. So pretty soon, I was in the nurse's office with a bleeding head. And the rest of the whole trip was pretty calm. I was dead a lot of the time.
Do you have a happier story you can tell? Did I ever drop you?
Well,
I remember
on
the beach with Joe in San Diego.
Oh, the beach in San Diego.
Oh my, what happened?
We just picked up shells.
Was the surf high?
I
We were talking the other night about how crowded and how the village changes when it's really crowded or really empty, and I was recalling a summer where I was on the staff and it was so crowded in Lodge 1 where I was staying that we had two beds and then two people on the floor next to the beds, four people per room, and it got old and I had a chance to move a mattress to one of the chalets and stay upstairs with a friend, and it was great, and it certainly changes your workload somehow to have a space. Your environment changes it, the way you face the bummer.
What those mountains reminded me of was the place that I was thinking of, Priest Lake, Idaho, very north Idaho, very way up in the Panhandle. And one summer, I spent about a week in a lodge there. And what I remember best about the place is where I read The Lord of the Rings, which I thought was one of the greatest fantasy and good and evil stories. I could just, mm-hmm. I just read nonstop for 3 days. And although there was a mountain about like that across the lake, and I'd been at the place where both of those things would be there. I don't remember the mountain and the lake so much as I remember the books. You know, that trilogy was just one of the greatest reading experiences I'd ever had to that point.
My turn?
Yep, your turn.
I remember a room in Paris at the top of a 5 or 6 story apartment building, Avenue de Saxe it was on, 127 steps up. You had to go into this little courtyard, a little light well actually, and then up this very narrow stair, 127 steps, which is why we never came down to buy a fresh baguette for breakfast. We would always use the stale baguette from the night before. And the room was one of the dormer rooms. It was in the attic. And it was barely 7 feet wide. I could almost touch from one end of the room to the other. And it was about twice as long, about 14 feet long. It was a narrow bed and a dresser drawer and a small teeny sink, a couple of shelves, And then this window, which seemed remarkably small from the outside, when you looked up at this building and saw one of these dormer windows, it didn't look very big. But from the inside, given the size of this room, it was huge, and it was our connection to the world. And we didn't have a refrigerator, and so just outside that window was a gutter. And we kept an orange crate out there, and that's where we would keep things like milk and perishable items that would last for a couple of days. And that's a room that I remember extraordinarily well. It's one that Ann and I spent 6 months in right after we got married in 1974.
Thank you. What a interesting. Now, Zorba the Greek says, tell me where you've been, what you've done, and how it changed you.
Excuse me. Is that another one?
Yeah.
Okay. In my grandparents' house last summer, they live in Portland Lake, and they're like right on the lake.
Uh-huh.
And they have their house, and it's pretty steep going down the lake, so the house just kind of shoots out like from the hillside. And then there's a porch going off of it. It's blue. And if you open the porch door and you go up, they cleared some of the trees away in front of it. And you know how sometimes like the sky is pink? Okay, they're like uh-huh. so smooth that it was reflecting the pink.
Uh-huh.
So I walked down the thing and it was, trees were gone, and they cut away the trees in front of the porch. And I walked out to the very end, took the porch, it looks like this. And then I looked out and you can't, it's like, you're looking down and you just see the water, and you can't see anything else because it just goes 5 minutes to the sides. So it looks like you're either gonna fall or flop.
Yeah.
I never really had, I've been there tons, every day, every year of my life, so I was like, I never had that experience. Whoa. And maybe take a step back.
So was the sky and the water the same color?
Yeah, it was just that pink it gets and that rose quartz pink.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to?
Yeah, I've got a story.
Good.
I didn't catch that part first time around, Mark.
That's okay. That's what repetition's for.
But holding the rock made me think about, well, you could skip it, but it'd be take a vigorous throw. You know, skip this on a stream or a lake or a pond or something. And I remember, you know, the boys and skipping rocks on water, something that maybe, I don't know, genetic. But my dad taught me how to skip rocks, and coming upon a body of water, I'd pick up stones and skip rocks. And I taught my son, and he, you know, comes upon a body of water and he skips rocks. It's just something that we do.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful, magical experience.
Yeah.
These rocks can skip.
Girls don't take to that. We were talking about that earlier today, about the differences between boys and girls. Do you skip rocks?
Yeah.
There you go. Well, I have here around my neck a chain of keys. And I think about what that story you just told about the Lord of the Rings and the mountains. I too was reading the Lord of the Rings the first time I arrived at Holden Village. And the first trip I took out of the village was to the old miners' village, where the ruins of the old miners' houses still lay. And I think to myself, when I listen to these keys, that these keys are keys to doors that no longer open. And the miners' village was also a place of the past. And certainly all these places that we are recalling are, even though they perhaps exist now because we're not in them at the moment, are in another place. And when we share these stories, we brought them back, and we've all been able to travel through them. So I think we all deserve a hand. Thank you.
Thank you, Molly.
Thank you.